Page 103 of The Unfolding is the story of Darth Lee.
And when we came out, we thought that the war was over. And in so many ways, we were glad. We thought that we can return to live somewhat a normal life. But what we didn't know was that our nightmares, they were just beginning.
God's story has been unfolding.
Since the beginning of time.
He invites you to be a part of it.
Another page in The Unfolding.
Hey, this is Meredith Foster. From 1975 to 1979, Cambodia was ruled by the radical communist group, the Khmer Rouge. It was a time of horror, bloodshed, and genocide. It's among the darkest periods in human history, when nearly a quarter of the population of Cambodia, about 2 million people, died. When the Khmer Rouge took over, Darth Lee was only 7 years old. Separated from his family, he experienced atrocities that most of us can't even imagine. I think Darth's story is an important one to hear, but if you're listening in the car or someplace where kids can hear, you're probably going to want to wait and listen another time. This story includes violence, torture, and death. It's a very heavy story, but also an incredibly hopeful one. It's a story that illustrates the verse in Genesis that says, "What was meant for harm, even one of the most evil chapters in human history, God can turn for good."
In the 60s and then early 70s, the war kind of taken place in this part of the world that come to be known as the Vietnam War. I was born in a province called Kampong Cham, which borders between Vietnam and Cambodia. As the war spread from Vietnam into Cambodia because of the bombings, and I was quite young, I was a couple years old, my mother took her two children, myself and my sister, and we fled the bombings and came to the capital of Cambodia in 73 or something like that. We survived by just, my mother was making little cake, dessert snacks, and sell it all on the streets to survive, to get some income to survive. And my father stayed behind at a home village. And so the separation between me and my father and, of course, our family from that point on. And so till this day, I have no memory of my father. And so I don't even know what his name was and what he's looked like. From that point on, we were staying in the capital in Phnom Penh. And as the war rages in the countryside, and so more and more refugees from the countryside flooded to the capital in search of course, refuge, in search of safety. And then in 1975, the radical communists known as the Khmer Rouge came to power in Cambodia as the Americans pull out of Cambodia. And I was 7 years old at that point. And I remember we went into the bomb shelters because a couple weeks before the city fell, the city was under siege and they were just bombing into the cities. And so we had to stay in the bomb shelter for a couple weeks. And when we came out, we thought that the war was over. And in so many ways, we were glad. We were happy that the war was over. And we thought that we can return to live somewhat a normal life. But what we didn't know was that our nightmares, they were just beginning. And so I remember as a child at the age of 7 years old, coming out in a daze after the bombings, we met these soldiers. They came into the cities with their uniforms, basically just black pajama, and they were waving their AK-47s and they were shouting. And then within the same hour, things turned for the worse as they started to shoot into the air. And then they told us that we need to get out of the country, the city. And they said the Americans gonna bomb. And so for our own safety, we need to get out. And so some people believed them and some people didn't believe them. But then within the next couple of hours, then they forced people to leave. And I remember just walking out with only the clothes on my back with my mother and my sister and other relatives with tanks behind us. They forced us to march out into the countryside. We didn't know where we were going. There was only one direction because of just these mass of humanities were pushed out And so we didn't have any options other than just to go along. We marched out, and I remember seeing corpses on the side of the road and seeing people with bundles on their heads and fleeing and see houses burnings and all that. I didn't know what was happening, but we just kept on walking because we were afraid. Eventually, several days later, when people kind of got out into the countryside, we found a place, kind of shelter to stay for a couple of days. And then the Khmer Rouge, they came around and they started to round people up. For us, they round us up and they put us in military trucks and just packed us in the trucks. There were several thousand people that were at this particular location where my family was. And they pack us in the truck and they ship us across the country back to the capital, and then went on the other side of the city. We drove for a whole day. I remember getting on a truck in the morning, and then by the time we got to where they wanted us, it was at nighttime. We didn't have anything to eat. They didn't give us anything to eat for the whole day. And once we got to this particular location where they wanted us, we just kind of stayed under a tree for the night. And then in the morning, the villagers came, and they came with the ox carts. And then they put us in the ox carts, and they took us for several more hours until we got to this place where we put in labor camps, basically. And so they separated us, and they took me away from my mother and my sister, and they sent me to a labor camp for children. And of course, my mother went to a different labor camp, and my sister did the same thing.
Do you remember that experience? Do you remember what you felt in that moment?
I remember the memories, and some of the feelings. Yes, of course, I was scared, but I remember clung on to my mother's leg and didn't want to go. But of course, they just with force separated me and put me on a cart and then sent me off to the labor camp.
At that stage in your life, did you have any notion of a God? Was there any type of religion in your family? Was there any thoughts of like crying out to a higher being? And
I didn't have any notion. I didn't have any idea that there's a God. And so my family, just like most of Cambodians, we're growing up being Buddhist by culture. And so in Buddhism, there's no sense of a God, a creator that would, you know, that would hear our prayer. Of course, they believe in different spirits and that, but I was too young to even process that. So I didn't have any notions of any higher power. Now, to give a kind of a background to this is, as some of your listeners might remember, in 1975, this radical communist came to power, the Khmer Rouge. And so led by an evil man by the name of Pol Pot. When Pol Pot came to power, he wanted to turn the country, to turn Cambodia into some kind of an agrarian utopia communist state. And so to accomplish his goal, he began a systematic slaughter where they empty all the towns and all the cities, and people were forced to leave their homes, to leave their family members and go out, go into the countryside. And then they round people up, those that had any connection with the previous government and those that were from the city, especially the capital city, Phnom Penh. And they round these people up and then with their entire families, and they basically slaughter them. They have a saying that people's life is not worth a bullet. And so they would not waste a bullet to even shoot and kill people that way. But rather, they came up with different methods of tortures and killings. And so this would happen after the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. And so the Khmer Rouge, they targeted the educated people, especially those that were from the city. They wanted to start the country from the beginning. They wanted to turn the country to the year zero. They wanted to get rid of those that were educated, those were corrupted by the Western world, and then brainwash the children. But for me, because the fact we were not an upper class, we were just the peasant, but we were from the city when they got to us, meaning we found ourselves in the capital. So because of that, I was put in this labor camp. And so there were several thousand children in this particular labor camp. And they didn't give us much food to eat. We were giving one small cup of rice water. What it is, they put a handful of rice in a big pot and fill that with water and boil that. And each child would get one small cup of that, basically just rice water. And in addition to that, they forced us to work in the rice paddies from sunup to sundown as they forced us to dig channels and build dikes in the rice paddies. The work itself, I don't think it provides any benefits to the overall rice farming, but as a way to keep us occupied and literally work us to death. And we would work from sunup to sundown, and sometimes if there was a full moon through the night, masses of children died from overwork and starvation. And I was able to stay alive by eating different kinds of roots, leaves, bugs. But they would also, in addition to the forced labor and the starvation, they would torture us. Every day around noon, when it's the hottest time of the day, they would tell us to sit in the mud in the rice paddies, and they would come by and they would randomly, they have some kind of cost, but for the most part, which is random selection, the kids that they don't like, they would select a handful of children, 6-7 of us at a time. And those that were being selected were brought to the front, and they would tie them up with their feet together and their arms behind their back. And those of us that were not being selected were forced to watch as they would torture and kill the children in front of us. And then I remember distinctly, they looked at me and they said, "Don't turn away because you will be next." I remember just this scream and of course, just the blood and the just the gore of it. And so this would take place many more times after that. But like I've said, I was able to survive by finding different insects and stuff like that to eat while working in the rice paddies. And so one day while I was working, I saw a snail bopping in the mud right next to me. And before the other children could get their hands on that, and because I was the closest to it, I quickly picked it up. And I knew that they would probably kill me. But because the hunger was so intense that I just didn't care at that point whether I live or die anymore. And so I broke the shell off and I ate the snail. And sure enough, one of the guards were watching me and they came over and they beat me with the bamboo canes. Now, these guards, they're just kids themselves, 15, 16-year-old kids. They were the children of the Khmer Rouge, and so they were watching us. And so some of the guards had guns, had AK-47, but some didn't have anything other than bamboo canes. And so they used the canes to beat me and then push me into the mud. And then they tied my feet together and then my arms behind my back, and they dragged me across the rice paddies to the place that we would come to sleep at night. It's about a half a mile away. This place was just a higher ground, just a hill where it wouldn't get flooded, and it's out in the open. And so we would just sleep out in the open. But they dragged me to this place. And when we got to this place, they found a tree that was full of these red ants. And so they tied me against a tree and left me there, waited until the rest of the children came back at night, tied me to the tree and let the ants bite me. And once the children came back, they untied me from the tree, and then they forced the rest of the children to make a circle around me, and they picked me up and stood me on my feet. And then they had a statement for the children to say, to repeat after them. And the statement was in a sense that I was bad, I was against their rule, against the organizations, that they would not follow the children, they would not follow my example. And after the children kind of mindlessly repeat this statement, then they forced the children to beat me. And then I, of course, my feet were remained bound together. I would fall and they picked me up, and the next child would come and repeat the process. Now, at that point, we still had a lot of children that were still alive. And so from being beaten, from being stomped on and kicked, I was unconscious. And then I think they thought that I was dead, so they just left me there. And then the kids went to get some sleep for a couple of hours before morning. And then they off to work in the rice paddy again. And then around midday or so, I found myself alive, still alive. And I remember just being so thirsty. And so I crawl on my elbows to the edge of that high ground to the rice paddies where I get some water and then just lay there. I didn't have enough strength to do anything beyond that. And then at night, they came back and they realized that I was still alive. And so they beat me some more. And then they said, next time we will finish you off. But for now, looking back, it's the hand of God. But at that point, for no particular reason, they let me live because that was unusual.
As you were going through that ordeal, did you think you were going to die?
I was, yes. I had given up hope that I was going to make it. So, yeah, I thought I was going to die.
Yeah. Was the prospect of death at that point for you, what did that seem like to you?
It was not a scary thing. It was more like I'm giving up. I'm done. And so whatever happens, it happens. So the following day, I gained enough strength. And then they told me to go back to work in the rice paddies again. And it went on for a couple more years like that. And the children dying off from the killings and the starvation. Eventually, it's only, I think it's less than 50 children that were still alive. This is 1979. The Vietnamese invaded Cambodia.
And how old were you?
I was 10 years old. At that point, the 50 or so of us, the kids that were still alive, we were so emaciated, we couldn't, you know, stand up straight, much less work. And so they dragged us to the rice paddies and left us there to die. One day, it's kind of bombs exploded and guns went off and we didn't know what was happening. Those of us that had a little bit more strength, we dig a hole in the ground in the rice paddies on the side of the dike, and then we crawl in there, and then we stayed in there for a couple of hours while the shootings and the bombs were exploding all around us. And when that stopped, we crawl out and looked around and noticed that the guards, they were no longer there, and there was nobody other than the kids that were still there. We didn't know what was happening, but because the guards were gone, we thought, okay, maybe we can go and find a village and trying to find something to eat or trying to find some people. And so we made our way towards a village that we knew that was there. Of course, we were so emaciated, we couldn't walk much. And so I remember just taking several steps and just kind of lay there in the rice paddies and then gain enough strength and took several more steps. Now, it took us several days before we got to a village, and we got to this village and the place was deserted. There was nobody around, but there was some food, and we kind of find what we could to eat and then continue to make our journey to a bigger village, to a provincial town. Now, it took me almost a week or so. I think it was like 6 or 7 days to walk from that small village to the provincial town. As we got closer to the provincial town, there were more people. I just kept on walking. And when I got to the provincial town, there were just quite a bit of people. But all of us was in the same condition, emaciated, couldn't walk very much. But there were adults as well at that point. And so I didn't know what to do. So I just kind of, and I was just so exhausted. I didn't have enough strength to continue on. And so I sat on the side of the road, just kind of didn't know what I was going to do. As I was sitting there, a woman walked by. And as she walked past me, she glanced down and looked at me, and then she kept on walking. And as she walked past me, she stopped, and then she decided to come back and turn around. And she asked what my name is. And after I told her, she said, she's my sister.
What?
Yeah. Not the same sister that I was with before the Khmer Rouge came in. She's my stepsister. Apparently, my father had a previous wife, and then he had a number of children with his first wife, and then his first wife died, and then he remarried my mother, and then had two more children. And so this sister was my stepsister. Wow. And then she told me about herself, and then she told me about her family. She said they kill her children. She had three children. They forced her to watch as they torture and kill her three children. And then she learned that they killed her husband from was in a different labor camp. And so she was the only one to survive. And so she was glad that a family member survived. And so she took me in and we kind of stayed on the side of the road. We found what we could to eat and different plants and fruits and insects. And then as people kind of clustered together, well, the Vietnamese continued to fight with the Khmer Rouge. And so at night we would hide. Well, you know, there were gunfights going on, but people continue to kind of cluster together and trying to figure out what can they do. I was in this particular group with my sister. There was about 100 or so people. And somebody within that group said, perhaps we can escape to Thailand. So one night we made the journey. We walked from where we were headed west towards the border between Cambodia and Thailand. During the day, we would hide in the brushes, in the bushes, and then at night, we would come out and we would walk all night. When we got to close to the border, there was a strip of land between Cambodia and Thailand that was, and it still is, full of landmines. At night, we would come out and we would walk. And then sure enough, every night from that point on, somebody would step on the landmines and then the explosion. And then those of us that were behind and in the front would hide. And when the smoke cleared, we would come out and sure enough, people would get their limbs blown off. These, what they called the anti-personnel landmines, they were intended to maim, not so much to kill. And so most of the time, the people that got blown off by these landmines, they were still alive. They got their legs blown off, but most of the time they were still alive and they were crying and they were pleading for help. But none of us was in any condition to help them. And so I remember one night, the explosion, and then I'd hide. And when I came out, there was several people laying there on the path and just crying and pleading. And I couldn't even get around them because of the landmines. And so because of people behind me, she kept pushing me to move on. I remember just stepping on them as they were pleading for help and continue to make our way. And so we spent about a week or so walking through these strips of land that were filled with landmines. By the time we got to Thailand, the group was reduced to around 25 or so people out of originally about 100 or so people. But against all the odds, my sister and I was among those that were still standing. Once we got to Thailand, at that point, the world, especially the United Nations, realized what was happening in Cambodia. And so they negotiated with the Thai government to allow the Cambodian refugees into the country. They put us in a bus and then they sent us to kind of a makeshift refugee camp. They didn't know what to do, I guess. So the UN asked different countries to take in refugees. About 5 months later, I found myself in Minnesota as an orphan. Well, I went with my sister as refugees. And then I don't know what happened to my sister. Several months later, we got separated and she went to Boston and I was stayed behind in Minnesota. And then I was placed in the care of the Ramsey County Child Protective Agency. They put me off in a foster home. My foster mother attended a church, a Summit Church. I went to stay with her and then she took in some other orphans as well. And then she would take us to church. And so from that point on, I went to church 3 times a week.
What did you make of that? So you're now what, about 11 years old?
Yes, I was 11 years old at that point.
So what did you make of church? Well, what a culture shock, I have to imagine.
Yes, it was. Well, I didn't know what they was talking about. I didn't know what they were doing. But I just remember the people who were really nice. And so I was happy to go because they were really nice to me. So that's all I was care about, you know. Mm-hmm. At that point, I had enough to eat and nobody was trying to kill me. And so that was all matter to me at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then they put me in school and I was, like I said, I was 11 years old at that point. And because of my age and at that time in the Twin Cities, there was not a whole lot of programs in terms of English, ESL. And so they just put me in. I remember I got there in May. And so because of my age, I went into sixth grade and I had 2 weeks of sixth grade. And of course, after that was summer break. And then I went on to seventh grade from that point on. My first school was Holmcroft in St. Paul. And they just put me in a class. And I just sat there. And then when I needed to move, because somebody would come and, you know, take me by the hand. And so I just did that. But all that didn't matter because I was saved, I had enough food to eat. And so in the same way at church, I just went to church and the people were so nice to me and they were so caring. And so I loved going to church at that point. So, yeah. And so several months went by, the months turned into a year. And at that point, I started to pick up the language and I was able to communicate some. A couple years went by and what happened was the nightmares started to show up. I would be awake in the middle of the night in a cold sweat because of the nightmares. And this would happen almost a couple times a week. And I didn't have the words to even express it to anybody. And so I just lived with that several years till I was 14. When I was 14, I picked up the language. I was part of the youth group. We had a retreat. I went to the retreat with the other kids and we had a speaker. The speaker was talking about accepting Christ and the other kids went forward. And so I guess I just wanted to fit in. So I went forward. I didn't understand much in terms of what the speaker was talking about, but I went forward and then I accept the Lord. I did it sincerely, even though I did not understand much, and nothing happened in terms physically. After the retreat, I went, we went back home and continued to live my life. Several months went by when I noticed that I didn't have any nightmares anymore. That just gone. And I was like, oh, wow. I'm praying. At that point, I started to understand what was happening to me. And I'm praying. I said, God, thank you for this. Thank you for taking away my nightmares. I want to serve you. Of course, being a teenager, I didn't know what that entailed, but I just pray that and then live my life as a teenager and then graduated from high school. When I graduated, I didn't know what to do, but I remember the prayer that I prayed to God. And so because Summit Church is part of a fellowship with the Assembly of God, we have a university in downtown Minneapolis. And growing up in the youth group, I was aware of the university and a couple of my friends in the youth group decided to go to North Central University. And so I thought that was for me as well because I remember my prayer. So I went to North Central. I had a missionary friend. Actually, he was working in the youth group and then we got connected. We developed relationship. And so I thought, well, he was major in mission. And so I was, decided to go that route as well. Fasting forward, when I was a senior at North Central, this in 1991, the country of Cambodia opened its door to the outside world. And so the Assembly of God, as a fellowship, we wanted to take an opportunity, that opportunity to put missionaries on the ground. We sent three missionary families into Cambodia. And one of those families is the friend that I was talking about that when he was working in the youth group. And so knowing my background, he wrote a letter asking if I was willing to come back to Cambodia to help him for just a short time. And of course, from the point I got to the U.S. to the point that I got this letter, I just forced myself to forget about Cambodia. And so when this letter arrived, I was confronted, before I even processed, I said, no way, there's no way I would want to go back and face that. And so I said, no, it was easy response. But as the summer progressed and in following year, the letters keep coming. And in between, the Holy Spirit kind of worked in my heart. And I kind of reasoned that perhaps I could go back to Cambodia and bring a closure to that part of my life. And then I can come back home to Minnesota and then live on my life. I agreed to come. And so in the summer of 1992, I returned to Cambodia for the first time after I fled this country as a child. I didn't know how to process, but it was just one of those things that I just decided to do. And so on the plane ride, I basically just numb. And then once we landed in Cambodia, and then I stepped off the stairways onto the tarmac, the first thing I remember was the heat just kind of hit me. And then after this wave of heat, it was a memory rush. I could feel it kind of rushing from my guts up to my mind. And so the heat, the smell, and the sight, the sound brought this rush of buried memories. And I was numb. I just didn't know what to do. And I wanted to turn around and just kind of walk back and get on the plane. But of course, that was not realistic. And so I just kept on walking. And of course, this missionary friend came to pick me up, and I just couldn't even express anything. I didn't say much. I was just trying to process this in my own head. A couple of days went by, and I thought about my mother. I said, I don't know what happened to her, but I thought perhaps she, my mother and my sister, perhaps they might be alive.
Can you imagine what Darth was experiencing? Back in his homeland, a place filled with horrific memories, but also the only memories of his family. And now there's this possibility that he might be able to find his mother. The search for her would change Darth's life in ways he never expected and never desired. Part two of his story is coming up. But first, a word from our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Habib, I've heard you say that we are stronger than we think, and we're able to handle more than we think. And I know from your story that you've learned that through experience. But for folks who haven't faced tough stuff or are walking through tough stuff right now who are questioning that, why do you believe it's true?
Well, you know, that saying sometimes could come across as harsh. But when I say that, I say it in a soft way because it happened in my own life. I was just so timid. I was afraid of my own tail, basically. And then you go through the challenges and you never know if you can handle it. But then God gives us a spirit of power, and you look back at it and you go, I made it. And it wasn't really me. It was God working through me. So my encouragement for the people that are having a tough time, I feel for you. I pray for you. Our heart breaks for you. But you can do it with the help of God. You are stronger than you think, and you're able to do more with God's help. So my prayer for you is that you believe that too.
And if you need a little encouragement along the way, there's some really encouraging stuff at Habib's website.
Yes, HabibHabib.com.
And now, part two of Darth Lee's story.
At that point, the missionaries, they were assigned driver to go with the foreigners. This Cambodian driver, I went to him and I asked him if he could help me find my mother. He said, of course. I contact my sister, my stepsister in the U.S., and I asked her basic questions about my mother, you know, what her name, where she was from, her home village. And with that, I provide this information to the driver, and then he took off. Then a week later, he came back. He said, I might be able to find your mother. And so I said, okay. And so we just followed the leads, and it took us four or five leads. Eventually, we found the person that knew where my mother was.
How did you feel when you had a realistic hope that you might actually get to see your mother?
In some ways, I was afraid. In some ways, I was excited. And then in some way, there was a little bit of shame as well. And so all that kind of combined into this unexpressible emotion. I was just kind of numb in some ways at that point. But I just went through the motion because at that point, I couldn't back out. And so, yes. The following day, the missionary friend and myself and the driver, we went to meet my mother. I don't remember the car ride because I was just kind of numb and I was just in my own head. But it took us about an hour to get there. We couldn't go all the way into a place because there was no road. And so we stopped. And at that point in Cambodia, there was not a whole lot of cars. There was not a whole lot of foreigners. And so any strangers, of course, would attract attention. And so we stopped the car and we got out and we started to walk. And the people, the neighborhood, they kind of looked us strangely. They looked at us and some even follow us. And so I just started following the driver. We parked about a couple blocks away, you know, American blocks. As I walked behind him, the driver decided to run ahead. And he ran ahead, and then he turned into the house where my mother was living. I looked up and I saw the driver, and then I saw a lady that was, her head was bald, she was skinny, she was squatting just in front of her, this shack, her place there, and she was doing something, and that kind of triggered a memory in my mind, but I kind of dismissed that. And then she looked up, and when she looked up, her eyes caught. At that point, I knew that was my mother. She just shot up, and then she just ran to me. And then because it's warm here in Cambodia, the ladies, for the most part, they don't wear the top. They just put their sarong, which is kind of skirt all the way up to the chest. And they don't wear a shirt, especially old ladies. And so my mother was like that. And when she ran, her skirt dropped down and she was exposed. And I was embarrassed at the same time. So I was shameful and all these emotions just kind of bubble up. And she ran and then she started to embrace me. And I just didn't know what to think. Part of me was just like, oh, I didn't want to be here. Can we go? But then the guilt and all that emotions kind of wrapped into one. And so I was kind of numb through the whole thing. And after that kind of a commotion, of course, everybody was watching us. And then we walked back and then she had a bamboo bed in front of her place there. And we sat on that bamboo bed and she started to cry. I started to cry because I didn't know what, you know, trying to process this. And until this day, I still don't know quite well what I was feeling at that point.
Sure.
Then she started to share with me about her own experience, what she was going through at that point. I just sat there and I listened for several hours. And then in the evening, the missionary friend said, well, I got to go. And so I was getting ready to get up and go. And he turned to me and said, well, you need to stay here with her. And I said, oh, I just, I didn't respond anyways. I just said, oh, and then I sat back down and he got into the truck and drove away. And I was like, I watched him go away. I said, I didn't want to be here. But then my mother, again, she hung up to my arm and she started to share some more of her story. She was telling me how she didn't have enough food to eat, how the Khmer Rouge tortured her, and how she stole some rice and they beat her. She showed me the scars on her face and on her body. And I would just numb the whole thing. I would just sit there and let her talk. She did most of the talking. I only respond in short phrases. And that evening, my mother made a bed for me on that bamboo bed. And I lay there. And of course, there's no way I could sleep. And all these thoughts and these emotions was running through my mind. And she had a spirit altar above my head there. And she was burning incense to it. And so the smell of the incense and all these emotions that I was going through, just kind of through the night, of course, I just couldn't sleep. And so in my heart, I didn't know what to do. And I was praying to the Lord. I said, God, please help my mother. And I didn't know what to do. And I said, God, do something to help this woman, my mother. And then the realization that the people in Cambodia, the entire country of Cambodia, every person was in that same condition as my mother. And so I was just praying and pleading God to do something to help my mother and the people of Cambodia. And I remember around 4 o'clock or so, the rooster was crowing and I just kind of lay there. And I remember the still voice of the Holy Spirit. And he said, yes, he will help my mother because Jesus had done it on the cross. He had done it all on the cross. And because of that, I can do something to help my mother and the people of Cambodia. I can give the message of hope and salvation to my mother and the people of Cambodia. Well, that was not what I wanted to hear.
That was not the response you were hoping for, huh?
No, I wanted God to miraculously to send somebody or to, you know, provide all these physical material things that she would need it, but the response was not that. And so I stayed with my mother that day. And so the following day, like around 11 or so in the morning, I was continued to listen as my mother continued to talk. But around that time, I saw a group of Buddhist monks. Now, the Buddhist monks, they wear this orange robes, and during the day, from the morning on to before 12 o'clock, they would walk the streets and they would stop in front of people's home, and the people would come out and offer rice and food as an offering. And so for me, after growing up in, you know, Minnesota, seeing the Buddhist monks was kind of a strange scene. I watched them walk around that area. Then my mother excused herself and she went and cooked some rice. You have to understand, my mother at that point didn't have enough rice to eat from day to day, but she had saved up a little bit of rice and she went and cooked that rice. And when she finished cooking the rice, she scooped it up and put in the rice bowls. And while I was watching the monks, they came around and they were standing in front of my mother's place there. Then I saw my mother got up and pick up the rice in the bowl, and then she walked out to meet the Buddhist monks. Of course, there was pain on her body. She was sick, and she walked slowly, and I could feel the pain in every step that she was taking. And there was four monks that were standing in front of her place there. And as I watched, she put the rice bowl on the ground, and then she bent down. She got on her knees, and she bowed before these monks. And then she got up, and then she picked up the rice bowl, and then she scooped a scoop of rice and put in this bowl that each monk carried. Each monk get a scoop. And then once she finished, she got back on her knees, and then she put her hands up in a way of kind of prostrate herself respectfully. And then the monks started to chant over her. And it was like a surreal scene before me as I watched. They chant quickly, and then they moved on. And then my mother walked back to me, and she put the rice bowl on that bamboo bed next to me. And then she sat down, and then I asked her, I said, "Mother, why didn't you eat the rice? Why did you have to give to the Buddhist monks?" She started to cry, and with tears running down her face, she looked at me. She said, "Son, I have known so much suffering in my life." And then she said, "I think I'm going to die soon." And from the look of her appearance, you know, I believed her. And then she said, "My only hope right now is that I would give enough rice to the Buddhist monks that when I die and reincarnate again, that I would not come back and live the same life I'm living today." And so what they believe is by giving the food to the Buddhist monks and by the monks chanting, that would turn into good karma. And so that's what she was talking about. When she said that, I looked at her. Here was this woman in front of me, so frail, so skinny, with tears running down her face, and she was telling me this. And I just realized, here's my mother, who had lived through so much suffering in her life, had no hope of living, yet the only hope that she had at that particular moment was a lie from the pit of hell. At that point, I understand what Jesus was talking about in the Gospel of John chapter 4, when he said, "Open your eyes." That short phrase kind of exploded in my mind. And all I hear is, "Open your eyes, open your eyes." Well, I was just overwhelmed by that. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to process it. But I forced myself to stay with my mother another day, another night. And in that night, I cried in my prayer even harder. I plead with the Lord. And I said, "God, do something. Do something, holy God. I don't know what, I don't know how, but please do something." Again, the Holy Spirit responded and said, "Yes, Jesus had done it all. And because of that, I could do something. I could give the message of hope and salvation to my mother and the people of Cambodia." Well, I didn't want to hear that. And so the next day I left my mother, the missionary came back to pick me up. And then subsequent days, we went back and visited her several more times. But 3 weeks later, I left Cambodia and came back to Minnesota and then picked up my life from where I left off. And I graduated from North Central. And then I got a job as a counselor at a group home. I was working. I try to forget what my experience was in Cambodia, trying to deal with that in terms of trying to put that behind me as best I can and trying to move on with life. And then I was thinking, okay, maybe I can plant a church in the Twin Cities. I got married But the calling, the words of the Holy Spirit and the image of my mother, I couldn't shake that. Every time I close my eyes and go to bed, that image and that sound would pop into my head. And so finally, I just said, okay, I surrender, Lord. In 1995, my wife and I submitted an application to the Assembly of God World Mission to see if they would send us back to Cambodia as missionaries. Now, when I did that, I know that they would turn us down because there is a policy that they still have today that they don't send back nationals to their home country as missionaries. And so I'm thinking, okay, if I just do this, they would turn us down and I would in some way release of my obligation. And then I would just, you know, go back to my life. But obviously that didn't happen. So they made an exception for us. I remember winning and sat before the committee and they interview us. And the whole time I was waiting to say, they would say, well, you know, we can't let you do this. So that was, I was hoping that. But when they said, well, we're going to let you go, we're going to make an exception, my heart literally sank. I just like, oh, no. We kind of went through, I'm getting a little emotion here.
But that's okay. There's a lot of emotion packed into your story.
Yes. And so we began the process of itinerating, raising funds to come back to Cambodia. We didn't know a whole lot of people, a whole lot of churches, but God provided, and we returned to Cambodia as missionaries in 1996, and we were asked to run an orphanage, and so we had been doing that ever since, although we're not running an orphanage anymore, but now we're doing schools, so we have been doing schools, we're planting churches, we're training pastors and church leaders, and right now we have four schools that we partner with One Child, and we are helping and ministering to over 3,000 children daily in our schools, in our four schools. We provide a place for the children to learn how to read and write, but more importantly, a place for them to receive the love of Jesus Christ. And we provide nutrition, we provide school supplies and healthcare. And over the years, we have seen God sort of raise up leaders and believers. Our goal is to raise up destiny changers that would transform Cambodia for the kingdom. And so that's what we're doing. And we'll continue to do that as long as the Lord allows us to do so in this part of the world. So
just the amount of suffering, the amount of evil you were exposed to as a child is mind-boggling. But it keeps bringing to mind to me that the scripture that talks about what was meant for evil, that somehow God turns it for good.
And that is one of my favorite verses in the Bible. It's Genesis 50:20, when Joseph said to his brothers, you know, you intended to harm me, but God turned it for good to accomplish his purpose. Now being done, the saving of lives. And so I looked at through that lens of that scripture. I think my life and then what happened in Cambodia is also part of that. The enemy, every moment of our life, intended for evil. But God used those intentions of the enemy and turned it for good to accomplish his purpose. Sometimes we might not see it at the moment, only when we go through it and then look back where we see the hands of God kind of shape and use that. Of course, you know, as the Bible story of Genesis, the story of Joseph, we can see that. But in my own life, I can see that as well. Whether the country of Cambodia, you know, I think if the killing fields did not happen in Cambodia, the country would not be open as it is right now. And right now we have the freedom, we have the gospel of Jesus Christ in Cambodia. And within the last 20 years, if you look at statistically, look at from a number point of view, is we have one of the fastest growing church in the world because the people are open, the people are looking for answer. I look at it and that's because of what happened in terms of the history of this country. And I look at my own life and I look at what's happening in our world today. Look at, you know, even with the pandemic, what happened to our ministry during the pandemic is because of the restriction, the Lord had opened other avenues for us to minister that is more, that provide more depth, that is more, make more impact, not so much in terms of the number, but a spiritual development and impact, greater impact in some ways. And so I'm not saying God caused all these bad things to happen. That's the result of the enemy and the result of the fallen world that we're living in. But what the enemy intended for evil, God has turned that for good to accomplish his purpose. That's how I see it.
It's hard to imagine just surviving what Darth went through. And then now to see him and his family back in his homeland, thriving, sharing the gospel, helping thousands of kids, and transforming Cambodia. God really has taken what was meant for evil, and he is using it for good. I asked Darth how we could be praying for him and for their ministry, and he said a couple of things. Their immediate need is for the struggle with COVID. They're experiencing lockdowns and curfews, and that impacts how they can interact with the kids through their schools. So just pray that their schools are able to open again. And then also pray for a new church that they're planting about 3 hours away. Because of travel restrictions, they haven't been able to serve this new group of believers in the way they'd like to. And one more thing, I asked Darth about his sister, his full sister that he was separated from at 7. He was able to find her too. She is living with his mother and both are doing well. If you want to learn more about Darth, head to his website. It's darthlee.com. It's darethly.com. We're so grateful to Darth for sharing his story. Thanks to Courtney Canfield for tipping me off to Darth's incredible story. We're always looking for great story ideas, by the way. In fact, each Christmas, we do a special episode of stories about angel encounters. If you know of someone with a story to share, head to the Unfolding Podcast Facebook page and let us know. Thanks to Jason Rackow for his excellent production skills. Thanks to our sponsor, Habib Habib, founder of H Squared Leadership Institute. Head to HabibHabib.com to learn more about Live to Lead, a leadership and personal growth event featuring John Maxwell coming up soon. The Unfolding is produced by Northwestern Media, a ministry of the University of Northwestern St. Paul. We'll be back next week with another page in The Unfolding.